This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're continuing today with our series on Earth Consciousness and Lore of the Amazon, a symposium presented by Synergetic Press, south of Santa Fe. I'd like now to welcome Dennis McKenna. He's an ethnopharmacologist. He's founding board member of the Hefter Research Institute. He's an assistant professor at the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota. And he's author of the book, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, My Life with Terence McKenna. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you have written a memoir, and you've really spent your life devoted to a set of activities that started when you were a teenager and when your older brother, Terence McKenna, who became very famous and had kind of a cult following, and although he's passed away, still does, He then you got involved in that kind of almost archetypal 1960s exploration of the mind and drugs and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit of what your early experiences were like in that area?
Well, yes, we got into all this in part because we grew up in the 60s and there was a lot of interest in psychedelics, and we were obviously interested in those things. But initially, I don't think it was a search for spiritual fulfillment or anything like that. It was simply curiosity about exploring consciousness. I would attribute science fiction, I would give science fiction as much of the credit for our interest as I would, say, our readings in Jungian psychology, which were also, he was someone we were both fascinated with. And my brother, as you say, was 4 years ahead of me, so he was further out on the cutting edge. And before I'd even finished high school, he was going to school in Berkeley. And he finished his last 2 years of high school in California and went to Berkeley. So, you know, he would come back in the summer and at Christmas time, usually with a lot of funny ideas. And which my parents didn't approve of, but I was fascinated with it. And we'd reached a point in our relationship where, you know, we'd sort of evolved beyond the sibling rivalries. And for him to come home was a big treat for me because we discovered, you know, these common interests. And he would come back with many interesting ideas and sometimes interesting substances, which we would share. And, I mean, he turned me on to cannabis in the city park across from our house, and it would have been the summer of 1966, you know. The thing that fascinated both Terence and myself, you know, everyone was excited about LSD, and we were excited about that, but the thing that really grabbed our attention at the time was DMT. And DMT was very rare in the 60s. It was around. You couldn't really find it very easily. And when you did, you found, you know, a material that was far from a pure synthesis. But Terence had connections and worked the matrix, and DMT emerged out of it. And we both agreed that it was the most interesting psychedelic that we'd ever encountered. And more than just a psychedelic, it was kind of the most interesting thing, the most interesting phenomenon that we'd ever run into. And we thought, you know, we have to investigate this further. Actually, nothing else is quite as important as looking at that.
Now, when you say interesting, what do you mean?
Amazing, astonishing.
What was it like?
It's very hard to describe. It was a typical, if you can use that term, psychedelic, but it was a typical psychedelic compressed into 10 or 15 minutes. And it was a full-on, like penetrating into another dimension in some ways. Like some, it's like, I often make the analogy that it's like there's a parallel universe just hidden that we don't normally get to, we're not normally aware of, but we get to stick our heads into that universe for a few minutes when you take DMT and look around. And when you look around, you see this very busy place that's carnival-like. It's kind of funny. There are entities there. They're very happy that you're there. They're bouncing around. They're having a good time. They invite you to have a good time. And it's just astonishing. And it's like this ongoing cosmic carnival in a parallel dimension. The problem with the DMT is it's so short, it only lasts about 20 minutes, and it's hard to come back with much other than just a general impression that it was an utterly astonishing, amazing experience, but you don't really have time to comprehend much more than that. So that was partly what motivated us to go to South America in 1971, because we were looking for an orally active form of DMT. DMT is not orally active by itself, but we were looking for an orally active form of DMT so that we could spend longer in that place and then perhaps understand it better. So that was a rationale for going on this search for these exotic hallucinogens.
And the orally active form is ayahuasca?
Well, it turns out, yes, it turns out ayahuasca is an orally active form because it has the enzymes in one of the plants it's made from that inhibit, it has the alkaloids that inhibit the enzyme monoamine oxidase in the gut that breaks DMT down. So ayahuasca is an orally active, a way to orally activate DMT. We weren't looking for that when, I mean, we knew about it, but we were looking for something else when we went to South America, a different orally active DMT-containing plant, which nobody even knows about much to this day, derived from different plants called Varola. And that was really why we set out to go to La Chirera, was to get Varola, to get this medicine, which was called Ukuhe, the Watoto Indians used it. We thought that was the holy grail. That was the orally active form of DMT. And it was, but it took us, we didn't actually get it the first time we went to La Chirera. What we did encounter when we got to La Chirera was abundant psilocybin mushrooms in the pasture where of this mission village, and it turns out psilocybin is also a perfect orally active form of DMT.
Now, when you started off a moment ago, you were talking about how you were looking at things like you were really interested in science fiction and the work of Carl Jung and other readings and the experiences that hallucinogenic drugs gave you, and they're all somehow, all of those things in some ways are of a piece, a kind of exploratory piece. Mm-hmm. What was the draw of that? I mean, what was, I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, but like what was missing in your lives? What was missing in the culture that so many people were drawn to that kind of exploration?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, it's hard to say based on our particular existential situation. All we knew was that, you know, because of our interest in science fiction and obscure things, not just science fiction, we were interested in esoteric things. For some reason, we were drawn to that. UFOs,
right.
Paranormal phenomena, all that stuff was very attractive and interesting to us. We were just curious geeks, you know. We were not really like our contemporaries. We fancied ourselves intellectuals. I guess we were kind of intellectuals. We were what one would call nerds now, but back in the day that word didn't exist. But we were kind of like that. We were curious. We thought the world was an amazing place, and we wanted to understand things. And this phenomenon of psychedelics, I guess the initial attraction was when we started reading about psychedelics, it was like, oh, you know, all this stuff about other realities, other dimensions, time travel, all of the things that you read about in science fiction, it's actually maybe possible to do that.
Right.
Not just think about it, not just read about it. So that was our motivation, you know.
And when you're an adolescent, the idea that you can actually
go there.
Time travel or whatever.
Yeah. So that was really it. That was really it. Yeah. That's what got us into it. And then another major component, you know, psychedelics, when they came into Western culture through LSD, there was no context for this. There was no, very few people knew about the indigenous traditions. I mean, even Leary, who was like the major cultural spokesman for it, he never really invoked that much. And so when I read The Teachings of Don Juan, which is mostly probably not true, but it did present to me a whole new perspective on this, you know, an understanding that, yeah, actually these substances have been used for thousands of years by indigenous cultures. So if you want to learn how to use them, talk to those people. Don't talk to the contemporary cultural representatives, because they're as clueless as you are, you know, as me. I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't want to say that about Timothy Leary, but we were all clueless in that day. We were amazed and fascinated and didn't really understand it. So that was really a motivation to go to South America and try to follow up on this indigenous drug, which turned out, when we finally got it, took some time to get it, but when we finally got it, turned out to be not so interesting.
Well, this is the thing that I wonder. I mean, here you have in the 1960s and 70s and ever since, really, scads of Americans and Westerners who certainly are not enveloped in any kind of land-based indigenous tradition, by and large, trooping down to South America. And you can almost like see the indigenous people saying, oh, here's another one, you know, here's another group of them coming.
Yeah.
But you still, even though you might be there geographically and talking to the people, you still didn't grow up and didn't have that context.
No.
So what did you get? I mean, is it possible to put yourself in their shoes and see what those substances are for them? Do you feel that you were able to do that?
Well, yeah, to a certain degree. I mean, if you hang out with these people, you know, you do learn from them. And some gringos go to South America and they get quite deeply into it, you know, to the point where they undergo the practices, they do the dieta, they get the calling to be a shaman or whatever. And some are sort of, you know, they sort of dabble in it. They're really dilettantes. Other people really do take it on and they become quite serious about it. This was never my or Terrence's. I don't think we ever saw ourselves as shaman or people that were going to, you know, administer the ayahuasca or other things to people in that capacity. We were more scientists and we just wanted to understand it. I never felt the calling to be a shaman, you know. I'm still kind of, partly because I feel like I've only been involved with ayahuasca for 40 years, I haven't learned enough from ayahuasca to qualify as a shaman. Other people, you know, after a few sessions, they feel that they're ready to hang their shingles out. I think they're kidding themselves in a certain way. What people don't understand is ayahuasca and these other medicines, they're not a shortcut to anything. You know, you've got to do the discipline, and you have to, if you really want to be a person who can use them therapeutically. I was not interested. I'm interested in it now, but at the time I was just interested in my own personal explorations and, you know, investigating these states of consciousness. And so that was what drove us.
We're talking to ethnopharmacologist Dennis McKenna. Now, that's a term, ethnopharmacologist, that probably many of our listeners haven't heard. What does it mean, and how did you go down that road?
Okay, well, I can give you the formal definition, right? Most people know what an ethnobotanist is. An ethnobotanist is a person who studies plants and the way that they're used by people. So you've got ethno, which is people, and botany. So ethnopharmacologist is the same thing. It's the study, I'll give you the formal definition, it's the interdisciplinary scientific study of biologically active substances used or observed by humans in indigenous cultures. So that's a long, awkward definition, but it's useful because, for one thing, it's not limited to plants. It's not limited to things that people might ingest. It's not limited to psychoactive. Certainly it has a lot to do with medicinal plants, but fungi are also included, and things like arrow poisons, which most people wouldn't ingest, but that would be a completely legitimate subject for ethnopharmacology. So it's learning about the active substances, how they work, how traditional people use them.
And so what were your studies like, and what did you learn? I mean, it seems like you and your brother and so many people were on a search for something. And
yeah,
did you find what you were looking for?
Yes and no. We didn't really find what we were looking for, because I think we didn't really know what we were looking for in a certain way, you know. And had we found what we were looking for, it's a difficult question to answer. I think we did, but it's not what we thought it was going to be. It was, when we set out to La Charrera to find this indigenous orally active tryptamine, on one level, that's what we were looking for, and that was kind of the ethnobotanical agenda. On another level, I think we thought that we were going to have a marvelous experience and an utterly life-transforming experience, and that would change everything. Not just us, but everything. And in that sense, I think it worked, you know, because we had a life-transforming experience and sort of created the myth of ourselves that is now out there in the culture. But one of the things that I think we actually brought back from our experiences that was concrete and did make a difference in society is we brought back the techniques for growing mushrooms. We brought back spores, and when we got back, we were very concerned to learn to grow mushrooms for a couple of reasons, so that we could have access to those experiences, but we also wanted to get them out, give this simple technology out to people so that they could have these experiences and either confirm or disconfirm that we were what we were experiencing, that they'll say, well, the McKenna boys are just crazy, or, wow, there really is something here, and I'm seeing aliens, and I'm traveling another. And that is, and I think that helped to change society. That was an important development in the penetration of psychedelics into society post-Leary, right? Because simple technology that did not depend on, you know, drug cartels and distribution networks, anybody could go to the grocery store and buy the supplies to grow mushrooms, and it was really pretty simple. So in that way, by distributing the knowledge, it had an influence. And we were among the first. We were not necessarily the first, but our little book, which we put out called Psilocybin Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide in 1975, it was nothing more than a little pamphlet, really. It was a small book, but it told how to do it. And many people did it and had the experiences, and I think that that was really a catalyst. I think that was had a catalytic effect in sort of keeping this in front of a lot of people, you know, and giving them the opportunity to explore these dimensions and confirm that we were onto something.
Well, and that is the question that I keep coming back to, and I just think it's an interesting and perhaps unanswerable question, which is, onto what? I mean, when you describe those early experiences of DMT, which lasted 10 or 15 minutes and were very vivid but hard to talk about. For all the world, it sounds like trying to describe a dream.
And it is a lot like that.
A dream is something that is definitely a human experience. It's very important, but whether or not dreams are meaningful and what they mean, you can debate forever, and maybe sometimes they mean something and a lot of times they don't. And again, I'm not really speaking very much from firsthand experience here, but from the experiences of you and so many people who have really gone through this, and especially gone through it in the 1960s and 70s, there is this sense of meaning and wonder, mm-hmm. and if I may say, some kind of like truth with a capital T. Or is it just like your brain having fun?
It can be all of those things, I think. I mean, that's the beauty of psychedelics in a certain way, and also, I don't know, maybe a limitation, but the beauty of psychedelics is that everyone's experience is unique. No one can have the experience for you, and it's up to you to make of it what you will. And some people will say, that was the most incredible, life-changing, enlightening experience I've ever had. And other people will say, well, it was interesting, but, you know, not so much. And other people will say, well, I, you know, felt like I toxified my brain. I'm never going to do that again. All responses are legitimate because nobody can have it for you. Nobody can do this for you. And that's another thing about another aspect of it is it doesn't require faith. Unlike most religious traditions, it does not require faith. You don't have to believe in anything to take a psychedelic. All you have to have is courage to do it. And then you have the experience, and then you have the freedom to make of it whatever you will. And people do, and I think that's good. I think that it's a tool that gives people direct access to this altered state, these altered states of consciousness, which religion and society and you know, the culture outside of psychedelics says these are forbidden to human experience, or they shouldn't be accessed by humans, you know, in human experience. Well, any time you tell a scientist that we shouldn't explore it, that's what you should be looking at. Because the purpose of science, the purpose of discovery, and is to push the envelope, you know, to try to function at the edges of what we know and what can be known. And I think these are great tools for exploring that, apart from all of the therapeutic applications that we see happening now. That's a very specific kind of use of them, and that's all good. I mean, they certainly, for many disorders or you know, things like PTSD and addictions and so on, the psychedelics are useful and better than most conventional medicines that we have. But to my feeling, as a curious scientist, a curious monkey, I call myself sometimes, you know, their real value is for exploring consciousness. And a bigger value is for exploring consciousness. I don't want to minimize their therapeutic uses, but it's not, I don't agree that people should, some people say you should always use it in a highly structured setting and for a therapeutic use or a spiritual use. I think it's good to have an intent, but I think it's also good not to put too much, not to control it too much. The medicine is the teacher, right? The medicine is the teacher. And indigenous cultures have this perspective that they call them, these are plant teachers. This is their understanding of it. And I think that's exactly true. So the person, so that makes, if they're the teacher, we're the students, right? Our job is to open our minds and pay attention. And that's really all that is required.
Dennis McKenna is an ethnopharmacologist. He's with the Hefter Research Institute and the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.